What was discussed by Sarah this morning on reconstruction from spherical means. Okay, I'll try to speak louder. So the first thing I'd like to mention that the work that Sarah talked about this morning together with myself and Rakesh, if you're interested in pursuing that, you can find a preprint at the MSRI website. So that is available there. And I also thought I would like to give you, maybe many of you know, she mentioned work by Kruger and others. That's a company called Optosonics. There's their website. In the red, there's a subdirectory publications where some of you can find some of their material. Some of the older papers as well as the newer papers are still there. At least they were at noon when I checked. Okay, so remind you of what we mean by a spherical mean for a compactly supported function is just the integral over the sphere. I will take the average divided by the measure of the sphere, so this is really the mean value. And if we're looking at functions on Rn, one could then ask for what submanifolds of, and that's both combination of center and radius. So this is a spherical mean function, though if a function of n variables is a function of n plus 1 variables. So the full measurements, of course, are overdetermined. And if you have for all centers and all radii, you take the limit as r goes to 0, you recover the function. So it's the question, certainly an overdetermined problem. One could ask for what submanifolds one can reconstruct the function. And when there is uniqueness, is there an inversion formula? So let me tell you a little bit about some of the history. One case that's been studied for a long time was the case where the centers are given to be lie on a hyperplane, and you assume all radii, and then it was, I'm told, first observed by Adamar that one can recover the even part of the function with respect to this, or if a priori one has knowledge that the function is supported on one side, one can recover the function. Although it wasn't, I'll mention later, until fairly recently that one has given, these were done by uniqueness results, done by moment conditions, and so there was no reconstruction formula in that case initially. The first class of situations for which there is a reconstruction formula have been found by Kunjarov by very deep and difficult methods, D-module theory. And let me just mention the situation that he looks at in the case is not where the centers are specified, but the submanifold consists of, for example, all spheres which are tangent to a hypersurface. Now, this is a very different situation than the one that we were considering, the one that Sarah talked about this morning, in two regards. First of all, this situation is projectively invariant. That is, tangency is preserved under projective transformations. And so this is a setting that maybe puts it also in the method where you might study this by, you know, things within a group of transformations that preserve such things, setting, say, in algebraic geometry, where one wants to look at projectively invariant properties. And it's also the situation where, if you look at the submanifold that you have, that it's characteristic for either the Darboux equation, which is satisfied by the spherical means, or the wave equation. So this is the case of what would constitute in integral geometry what's maybe called an admissible family in the Gelfand sense. And let's see, for Agranovsky and Quinto have done quite a bit of work, particularly in dimension 2, and given a complete classification of sets of centers, assuming that it's known for all radii, but sets of centers where there are non-uniqueness can hold when one works in the class of compactly supported functions. Okay. So, another inversion formulas. So, as far as I know, let's see, the first inversion formula, I think, for the hyperplane case in odd dimensions was given by Buchheim and Kardakoff. Coming closer to what Sarah mentioned this morning, the situation we were interested in, suggested by the problem in thermoacoustic tomography, where it's going to have centers on a sphere or a subset of the sphere and all possible radii. And here she mentioned Norton and Linzer gave series methods of inversion in 1981. Now, the point of view that we'll take is not only the integral geometry point of view, that is where we look at this as sort of, as she was doing this morning, you look at the operator, spherical means, perhaps you weight it, you compose it with its adjoint, and look at that as a generalized Radon transform. There's also an intimate connection with the wave equation in spherical means, and that's exploited in some of our work too. So I'll just remind you that if you look at the following initial value problem for the wave equation, then it's expressed in terms of the spherical mean, the solution is expressed in terms of the spherical means of the function by the following integral transform, which is local in odd dimensions and non-local in even dimensions. Okay. So, Sarah mentioned to you this morning we have inversion formulas when the set of the known set is a sphere cross R plus in odd dimensions under the assumption that the function has support inside the sphere. She showed you the particular formula for the case n equals 3. I'm going to tell you something about general odd dimensions here. And so we have the following particular operators, script n and script d, are just a weighting and a differential operator applied with respect to the radius of the sphere. And also make a note that if you look at d composed with n, that is up to a scalar factor, also the solution of the wave equation that I was mentioning, the initial value problem for the wave equation, can be expressed as the composition of those in odd dimensions. Computing the adjoints of those operators gives n star and d star formulas for them here. This is the generalized back projection that Sarah mentioned this morning, and this is just an adjoint of the weighting operator, of the differentiation operator. And then there are three forms for the reconstruction formula that give solution to analytical solution to the inversion problem for functions, initially say for smooth functions, compactly supported inside the ball. So I've taken the ball to be radius r. I've also put slightly different weightings here than Sarah did, so the formulas have a slightly different appearance, but these are essentially the same equivalent formulas. So I point out that there are two particular ones. This was what she called the row-filtered layergram, method, or the analog in here of that tomographic method. And these are two forms of filtered back projection. You notice that the differentiations and multiplications by T are commuted, or one pair of them is commuted between the two operators. Forms of the inversion formula. Let's see. She mentioned some comparison with the Radon inversion, and just remind you, here's the Radon inversion formula, the two forms of Radon inversion formula with Laplacian either on the inside applied to the back projection or Laplacian applied to the measurements. Okay. Now, the method of proof for three dimensions, Sarah went through this morning, but there's the method of proof in higher dimensions depends on a consequence of the three-dimensional one, but I'll state this result in more generality here. And it's some identities for the solutions of the wave equation where, again, the initial values, we're looking at the wave equation. Now, it's probably written down there. Right. Box U equals 0. with initial data 0 and initial derivative equal to f. And here again, we're supposing that the support of f is contained inside a ball of radius r. So if we have two such solutions, then the trace inequalities give a, this is a form of, say, a Poincaré type identity, giving the inner product of the initial data in terms of two forms of inner products on the boundary cross positive time of traces of derivatives of the solutions or product one of one solution and the second derivative of the others. Now, this one, you can go from here to here by an integration by parts, since we've, by our support assumption, the value of u at t equals 0 would be 0. So integration by parts on this applies to this one. This is symmetric, this is non-symmetric. And so there's some interesting consequences of the non-symmetry. This is another trace identity, which is subsequent work, not in the paper that I mentioned before, but expresses not also the initial data in terms of now the inner product of the spatial gradients of the solutions. And so in particular, you can see between these two that a phenomena which is well known in scattering theory in terms of the asymptotic behavior, if you think about the spheres expanding the not at a sphere of finite radius, but you take limits of solutions of wave equations as you go to infinity, then there's an equipartition of energy between the kinetic energy and the potential energy. But this already occurs in integrated form on sphere of finite radius as long as you're outside the support of the initial data. Okay. So in those trace identities, the integral was just from 0 to infinity. If you also, but we've taken only one of the possible initial conditions to be non-zero. If you take an integration over a bi-infinite cylinder instead, then you can use write a solution with, say, both the initial value and the initial and the value of the derivative non-zero as a sum of even and odd parts, and you'll have cancellation between those, and you can get an identity, sort of a trace identity on this, again, on a bi-infinite cylinder now with the full full initial data. Okay, so I want to, trace identity may seem a little bit, well, maybe it seems natural to some of you, and then I want you to explain to me why it seems natural to you, but I was going to say that it's no surprise in terms, if you think in terms of the Radon transform, and there is an obvious relation between, that Sarah mentioned this morning, between the Radon transform and the spherical mean transform. Now I have to put in a normalizing factor, which she didn't need, but if one looks at, say, in space at a given point here and thinks of a hyperplane perpendicular to this, so this might be a given direction omega, and a distance s here. And now one either looks at spheres of increasing radius, and so one could look at the spherical mean. Now, I'll do it slightly different. I will take radius rho in omega and then distance rho minus s. So that would be the integral over this sphere. So here we're at distance rho, and this is then rho minus s. But I've divided out by the radius, so we'd have to multiply by that. I've divided by the area of the sphere, so I'd have to multiply back by this. But the limit is then as rho goes to infinity of this is just the Radon transform of f at omega s. Now, similarly, you could, in fact, have taken spheres which are tangent going in the other direction, and they're sort of a symmetry condition also for the spherical mean transform. So a few of the things I'm going to mention to you are just thinking a little bit about this idea and what it might tell you of why this is a reasonable thing to expect for this energy identity in terms of what's known for the Radon transform. Let me just say, in fact, and put it in words here, in the three-dimensional case, then And it's well known that, easily proved by Fourier transform methods, that the L2 norm of a function f can be expressed in terms of the L2 norm of the derivative of the Radon transform, right? This is the limit as the radius goes to infinity of our formula for the trace inequality, for our trace identity. Okay, so I won't go through the details of that. So I'd like to give you a very quick outline of the proof of the higher dimensional form of the inversion formula, which is a consequence of the trace identities. So the first step is to prove the inversion formula in dimension 3, and that was done for us this morning. Then we use that to prove the non-symmetric form of the trace identity. And for the non-symmetric form of the trace identity, we obtain that by applying our inversion formula, our three-dimensional inversion formula, say to F1 and take the pairing inner product with F2, and then do the necessary integrations by parts or apply the adjoints of these operators. And one uses here that this is a solution of the wave equation. N, in this case, is t times the spherical mean, which is well known to be the solution of the wave equation in three dimensions. And so the solution of the wave equation with initial data Laplacian of f is the same as the second derivative of the solution, t derivative of the solution with initial data f, right? And so that gives us our solution here. Thus, we have the trace identity established in non-symmetric form of the trace identity established in dimension 3. Well, if one then looks at this here, we're going to use the spherical symmetry of the problem, and we'll see that to establish the trace identity in general, it suffices to take a decomposition of the functions for which one wants to prove the trace identity in radial functions times spherical harmonics. And one can ask then, what is it necessary for such initial data, and what does the solution look like? The solution, again, has the form of the initial data has the form of a radial function times a solid harmonic. Then the solution is a function of R and T times the solid harmonic. And provided that the A function satisfies this form of a Darboux equation. But the thing to notice here is that this only depends on the dimension plus twice the index of the harmonic. It's enough to prove the identity for such functions, but what have we already done? We've established it when n is 3 for all functions, and therefore when n is 3 for all k. But for any odd n, it can be written as 3 plus 2k for some k, and so it's now been established. The three-dimensional form establishes it in all odd dimensions as well. So once the trace identity is established, it then holds for all, the trace identity holds for all odd dimensions. And the reconstruction formulas, since the trace identities gave a pairing between initial data, two possible initial datas, and a trace on the boundary, if one applies the appropriate adjoints, then one has a reconstruction formula for all odd dimensions. So that's where those came from. We have not looked at the convergence of these in various function classes or studied the all the computations so far have been essentially formal and worked in, say, initial data of C0 infinity. Okay, so second content of some other things that I can find there, as well as the formulas. There's a uniqueness theorem. So here this is establishes a uniqueness. I'll make a quick remark that there are other ways of doing this too. That will now leave the situation of a sphere and will not be restricted to odd dimensions. It's not a formula. So if one assumes that one has here, it does necessary to have a convex region, and one has any relatively open subset gamma of the boundary of this convex region, and one knows that the function is a function is supported inside this region. One has then all radii for centers in gamma, then that uniquely determines the function. Now this can also be proved used by methods of Agranofsky and Quinto from analytic wavefront set methods, but we have some reason to think that our methods, which depend on unique continuation and domain of dependence, can also apply for not just for spherical means, but for wave equations with lower order terms or variable coefficients as well, and so are perhaps a more general approach to uniqueness theorems. Several other reconstruction formulas that we've given, again, now depend on odd dimensions, valid in odd dimensions, where there are two forms. So we'll assume no longer, again, limited to the sphere. So I'm drawing it, and of course it looks like a two-dimensional one. This is odd dimensions where this is applying. But if this was the omega, and then one could, if one has data only measured for diameter, for radii up to half the diameter of omega, so then if the spherical means are known for r in 0 to 1 half the diameter of omega, then f may be recovered. And I will say analytically, this is not by formula, but by solving an exterior initial boundary value problem for the wave equation, and then some other wave from the initial boundary value problem, you can determine the normal derivative. Once you know the normal derivative and the value of the solution on the boundary, then you could use a Kirchhoff formula to determine the initial data. Once you know the initial data, you compute the time derivative, the time derivative at the zero, and then that recovers your function that you're trying to determine. So a couple further remarks. You might ask, and in fact it was asked of me, what do the formulas do if the support of f, even in the spherical case, what happens to our inversion formulas if the support of f extends outside of the sphere? Well, it was a good question. And the answer is that they break down entirely, in the sense that if you apply them, you can even, inside the sphere, if you assume now the function was supported, you may get something of the wrong sign. Right? So it's a pretty dramatic failure of the inversion formulas. Case when the function may be, though compactly supported, is the support extends outside the domain of the sphere. Sarah talked a little bit this morning about the range conditions. I want to point out that there's one other range condition which may encompass some of those that we've noticed. There were two versions of the inversion formula, or at least, well, I wrote down three of them. If you compare two of them, there was a commutation between some t derivatives in there, right? Between a multiplication by t and a differentiation by t. If those both reconstruct, then the difference must be zero, at least inside the sphere. And then this gives a necessary range condition also. But I don't think it's sufficient. However, I have not been able to prove this. So I have to say that the necessary range condition does come from looking at those two. There's another necessary condition on the range. I don't think that's adequate, but we have not been able to give a characterization of the trace identity said that there was an isometry between the initial data and some subspace of the weighted L2 on the boundary. We're trying to identify what is that subspace, and this is a necessary condition, right, for the subspace, but we have not given a full identification. And then the other, there was the partial data problem that Sarah talked about this morning, but and one that I'm also interested in is in the full data for even dimensions, is there actually an analytic inversion formula? And that's something also that is still yet to be determined. Spent some time looking for it, but looking for such things, but I have neither found nor disproved that there can be one. Okay, thank you for your attention.
Are there questions?
Hi. David, just a quick comment on number one. It's sort of expected to break down because there's an null state of these Bessel functions.
I'm still working with compact support.
No, but even compact support.
Yeah. Yeah, as if you get outside where the domain of dependence of the back projection is.
Yeah.
Sure. Right? But so you might expect it to break down, but even if you take, I mean, just the simplest example is to take a characteristic function which extends, say, out to 3 times the radius, so that in the domain which you're doing the back projection, your solution of the wave equation is constant. You get a constant, but the wrong sign. And not only that, but if you apply the different reconstruction formulas depending on the formulas, you get different constants, each of the wrong signs. So it's a fairly dramatic breakdown.
Any more questions? Let's thank the speaker again.
Oh, and if anyone was interested, there were some questions this morning. I just happen to have reproductions of pictures of Kruger's experimental setup in one of his reconstructions, if anyone wanted to look at those. So.